This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks.
The weather is beautiful today.
It is indeed. Perfect for a wedding, a royal...
Don't you even start,
Anthony. All right. For you anti-royalists, it's a perfect day for our week in review as well.
Yes, it is. Though for Radio Boston's Anglophiles out there, you will get a little taste of what the Wills and Kate nuptial spectacular had, Bay State style, a little later this hour.
But first, the actual news this week included the battle over municipal union bargaining power. It moved to the state Senate after the House approved a $30.5 billion budget this week.
We're not going to let Massachusetts be the state that took away collective bargaining rights from workers of our state.
Meanwhile, Boston makes a major change in its payment in lieu of taxes program, which to a lot of nonprofits now just sounds a lot like taxes.
Also this week, the corruption trial of former House Speaker Sal DeMacy begins.
I'm just looking for my day in court. That's it. Not much to say. We'll do all our talking in the courtroom.
That sound courtesy of WCVB-TV. And while Sal DeMacy is reserving his talking for the courtroom, we're not. We'll be talking about the case and all the news of the past 7 days with our Week in Review panel, which today includes Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe. Welcome back, Renee.
Thank you.
Also with us is Craig Sandler, general manager and owner of the State House News Service. Hi there, Craig.
It's a great day for baseball.
It's always a great day for baseball.
Great American pastime.
And apple pie.
I think it's raining in England, isn't it?
Actually, I think the sun might be out there, so we'll see. But anyway, back to news of import here in the great Bay State of ours. I mean, we want to start off by talking about the budget and all the battles that actually went on Beacon Hill this week over that budget. It passed yesterday, the overall budget in the House, with just one lone dissenting vote, but a more contentious vote on that particular amendment regarding union bargaining rights and health care benefits happened Tuesday. That vote was closer, 111 to 42. So, Craig, let's start with you. This is now going off to the Senate. Your predictions on how it's going to fare there.
Well, it's really hard to make a prediction based on the way the senators, Reid, Senate President Therese Murray, are talking. That is to say, they aren't really talking right now. We the reporters at the news service did sort of an impromptu poll in the lobby of the Senate as they were going in and out of a short formal session yesterday, and nobody really wanted to send clear rhetorical signals. To me, that coverage read and those comments read like they're still waiting to see what signals Murray sends them. And that also means that she hasn't sent them clear signals yet. So far, if I had to predict, I would say that they will not agree with the House and they will not go along with these changes in rights. But I don't have any particular faith in my own prediction, because she has sent somewhat conflicting signals. She said that the House vote, you know, moves the needle forward on you know, what's called plan design, the changes in health benefits.
Renee?
Yeah. I mean, it's a sensitive matter, obviously, and the organized labor is very unhappy with this. But I do have to say, I think they're sort of hyperventilating about it because, you know, I'm sensitive or sympathetic to the union's cause, especially in this climate with so much union bashing going on. But the way I read it, it's really a very small step that's
You're
been
right.
taken in this House plan. I mean, it's only about copayments
and premiums
Copayments
and deductibles.
Yeah, not premiums.
Yeah, not
and
premiums.
You know, there's protections, and that, you know, it can't be any worse the deal than what the state employees get through the group insurance commission.
It's local option. The cities and towns don't have to do it.
Right. So it seems to me, you know, a step, but not a large. It's not. You know, we're not Wisconsin.
Well, but given that, I mean, we've had representatives of unions on the show here who say, sure, it's not Wisconsin, but in a Wisconsin-like climate nationwide, any step is a big step down that slippery slope. I mean, on our Facebook page, Jose Rodriguez wrote today, he said, whatever happened to negotiation? Is the answer to budget deficits really to take workers' hard-earned rights away? And here in Massachusetts, quote, where this sort of thing could never happen, it happened.
That's right. I mean, that is a very good way to put it, because it's Wisconsin-esque in relative terms. This being Massachusetts, it's pretty staggering. If you had told me 10 years ago this was – if you had asked me 10 years ago, is this going to happen 10 years from now, I would have said no.
I think it's a precedent that they have reason to be worried about, and so they're making a lot of noise to try to make sure that it stops.
That's the most important
thing. Stops here.
Yep.
But, we're talking about a budget in which payments for WIC, mothers, infants, and children have been slashed, and all kinds of other
youth
benefits
jobs.
Have been slashed. Yeah. And, to ask the public employees to, municipal employees to pay an extra $10 per visit to the doctors, in the larger scheme of things, there has to be a sense of shared sacrifice, and perhaps it isn't shared all the way up the income scale, but the employee unions, probably need to pitch in.
Mm, well, let's listen to Governor Deval Patrick reacting to the bargain amendment. Here he is a little earlier this week.
It was a very important vote for the House, but I want to continue to work on it. I think it's very important, by the way, that we dial down the rhetoric. This is not Wisconsin. That's not what the House did. That's not what I'm gonna. I'm not gonna sign a Wisconsin type bill in the end. We're gonna have a meaningful role for labor, and we are going to deliver on these savings for municipalities.
Craig, I saw that you wanted to react to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think he speaks to a theme of the whole week for me, watching what I thought was going to be quite an acrimonious or contentious process. Overall, I think that we saw a lot of good government this week. The vote was very bipartisan. You could quibble with the process, which increasingly year by year gets out of the public spotlight and out of the sunshine. But that I'm going to put that aside for now and just say that this was more or less a reasonable compromise that pleased both Democrats and Republicans and fit in very nicely with the reasoned, thoughtful tone you just heard from the governor.
Well, the one group that it didn't please, of course, is the municipal unions who come election time may show their displeasure. But, we've got to take a turn to you were speaking about good government to maybe some not so good government in Massachusetts, allegedly not so good government in Massachusetts, because as we mentioned at the top of the show this week, also the corruption trial of former House Speaker Sal DeMaese got underway. The trial's expected to take 6 to 8 weeks. Renee, that seems like an awfully long time, and with a lot of potentially high-profile people taking the stand. Your take on how that might affect the political scene here in the state?
It's a very complicated trial. There's a lot of allegations and cross-allegations. Speaker DeMaese, former speaker, has had a kind of some bad luck at the beginning. They lost several defense motions. It doesn't seem like it's shaping up to be very favorable to him, at least as far as the judges' rulings have gone so far. It's all about the jury, and they're having jury selection right now. You're looking at this long questionnaire that these jurors have to fill out to determine whether they can be impartial while at the same time not being utterly ignorant of state house doings or public policy. And I wonder really whether you can find a juror who would be able to have the intelligence to analyze this complicated case and still not have an opinion about it.
Craig, hang on for just a second, because I want to throw in another piece of tape here. This is from David Frank. He's a senior reporter for Massachusetts Lawyers Weekly, and he was talking about the federal court itself. Here he is on WCVB-TV.
There's a reason why the federal court is referred to by many as the House of Pain. Very few criminal defendants walk out of the building feeling good about what's happened.
So, Craig, based on that and what Renee was talking about, House of Pain for Sal DeMaese?
I mean, it really isn't looking good. When you think about some of the motions that were, they were dismissed because they were defense motions to allow testimony, tending to point to Sal DeMaese's acknowledgement of his own guilt. Right. Apparently now the jurors are going to hear
the
consciousness of guilt. That's right. Apparently the jury is now going to hear that testimony and from the people who were in on these alleged schemes. So there's nothing that we've seen so far that causes one to feel optimistic for Sal.
Governor Patrick is on the witness list in this trial. He obviously hasn't been accused of anything, but it still seems kind of a precarious political position to be connected to the trial in any way.
Definitely.
Renee, does it not?
Yeah.
It's difficult to say. I mean, I think the governor has actually made something of a issue about cleaning up Beacon Hill and, you know, getting reforms in lobbying and transportation and all kinds of things in his first term. Craig's shaking his head. So I think he's laid the groundwork, at least in the public's mind, that he is a clean government kind of guy.
I just think that people, you know, take in so little information about the state government in the course of a normal week that I would be willing to bet that half the people watching the coverage of the trial will see Patrick testify and think that he has done something wrong. I mean, that is the way that people
that's not his fault, though.
No, it's not. No, you're right about that. But nevertheless, I do think it's risky for that reason. You know, that's the other thing I was going to say about the jury is that, unfortunately, when you do polls, name recognition of the House Speaker and Senate President is so low, I think you probably could get jurors who, you know, capable of doing the trial simply because they can be impartial because they don't follow it closely enough.
Yeah.
But for that reason, it is so fraught in terms of the imagery of these top state officials all in federal court for something. I just don't think it's good for anybody.
It does seem like there's a secret tunnel between Beacon Hill and federal court sometimes. But anyway, moving on to the last topic of this week, Boston Mayor Thomas Menino sends a letter to the city's 40 largest not-for-profits, those with values of $15 million or more, and says, you know, that whole payment in lieu of taxes thing, let's up it to 25% of what you would actually owe. Oh, Renee, you know, what do you make of that move?
Well, first of all, it would be voluntary still. But it is a gutsy move and a delicate one on the part of the mayor because, you know, these institutions are the crown jewels in many ways of Boston's economy and of its culture. On the other hand, what was so striking and revelatory was the chart that ran in the Boston Globe showing the vast difference between some institutions' voluntary payments now, like Boston University, for example, is quite generous with its voluntary payments. Other universities pay zero, goose egg.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no consistency. I think that alone has, you know, raised the ante here. And, you know, I think what has to happen is for the institution's, you know, alumni and donors and supporters to, you know, start ratcheting up the pressure as well to try to get some equity here and get some of these institutions to do the right thing.
I mean, Craig, is there not something, at least to what the mayor's saying, or I guess has been saying for quite some time, that, yes, these are the jewels of the city's not-for-profit community, and one of the reasons why a lot of people look to Boston as a leadership city.
Sure.
But on the other hand, they also benefit from the services that are basically underwritten by everybody else.
That's right. Well, I mean, as long as he doesn't ask for too much, it's classic, really, negotiation dynamics. As long as he doesn't ask for too much too soon, I think he can be very effective in incremental increases in how much his institutions pay. And I saw him do this with local option taxes, you know, with hotel meals taxes. It went up year after year and got pounded, and those proposals were going nowhere. And in the end, he prevailed. And on Beacon Hill, you do it year after year, and 7, 8, 9, 15 years later, eventually, you will win on this issue. For all we know, he's still going to be mayor 15 years, right? So, you know, he's going to get that win. But I do think I think the way he's going about it is very effective.
Well, to put some numbers to this, I mean, we are talking about potentially significant sums. I mean, Renee, you mentioned Boston University. Of course, we're an affiliate of Boston University. But Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, for example, their voluntary contribution is about $167,000 this year. It'd be $750,000 next year and $3.1 million in 5 years. So that is quite a big change in the sum of money that the city would be seeing.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, Menino has also offered, you know, in-kind contributions as a way to, you know, make up this nut, you know, either through scholarships or through some sort of, you know, public service that the institution might provide instead. You know, many years ago, the Boston Globe magazine did an article that was really fascinating where the author walked across Boston and never stepped foot on for-profit property. He was able to walk. I mean, of course, in this article, they included the church, okay?
Right.
So church properties. But he was able to walk from, you know, West Roxbury to, you know, Beacon Hill.
That's Boston.
And never, and just step on not-for-profit properties.
And people know that.
That certainly does put it in perspective, doesn't it?
Politically, it can really play.
Well, it is time, before we run out of time, for our weekly Friday hubbub. Those are the stories that maybe didn't make it into our main body of conversation, but deserve a mention anyway. I'm going to bring Anthony back in here, and you get first crack at it, Anthony, your hubbub.
Thanks, Magna. Okay, my hubbub is a crime story. It involves a fugitive from justice with an Italian name, a hidden treasure, and a Boston connection, so what's not to like about this? So here it is. Last February, you all remember the name Enrico Ponzo, fugitive mobster from Boston. He was arrested in Idaho, where he'd been living under a different name for about 17 years. He was extradited back to Boston to face a number of charges, including attempted murder. Now, Ponzo had a friend in Idaho named Kelly Vercellis, who moved into Ponzo's house in Idaho and selflessly promised to take care of his house until Ponzo was a free man. And he told the New York Times, "What he did in the past, it ain't my right to know." Talk about unconditional friendship, right? Okay? Such a guy. Well, maybe not, because this week the New York Times reported that Kelly Vercellis was arrested along with two other men on conspiracy, burglary, and grand theft charges. They're accused of using a jackhammer to break through the foundation of Mr. Ponzo's house, where they found a metal safe. They used a blowtorch, and in it they allegedly stole $100,000 in cash, gold, and other valuables.
Wow.
So the question is, how did Vercellis know about this? Was Ponzo in on this? We don't know. But clearly there's a message here that you know, you got to be careful who you allow to house sit while you're
especially
away.
Especially in Idaho.
It involves a jackhammer, yeah.
Anyway, I love that story. No.
Renee?
That's great. Well, you know, on this beautiful day, I wanted to talk about Lilac Sunday, which is that spectacular celebration at the Arnold Arboretum that is tied to the peak bloom of the lilacs every year. And this year, it's being held on May 8th, next Sunday, which is earlier in previous years. Now, officially, it's to coincide with Mother's Day, but I think gardeners know better, because the peak lilac bloom has gotten steadily earlier over the years. In 1920, I looked this up, in 1920, Lilac Sunday, which is a venerable institution, has been going on for a century. In 1920, Lilac Sunday was on May 30th. In 1983, it was on May 16th.
Global warming.
This year, it's on May 8th. Global warming. You be the judge.
Not to be conflated with earlier onset of puberty. It's two different things, people.
Okay.
Correct. That's our talker next week.
That's right. So tune in.
On the other hand, earlier is better, because after a winter like we've had, Lilac Sunday can't come soon enough, if you ask me.
Well said.
But listeners, I did promise you a little taste
so
of a royal wedding. So, Craig, you're up with your hubbub.
All right. Well, it is culinary indeed, and it may miss our target audience on this show, but someone had to try the royal wedding donut at Dunkin' Donuts.
And you brought it in.
Here it is. Exactly.
Yum.
And so my quick review is that those donuts are like the royal wedding itself. They are sugary. They are a bit understated, and a little bit goes a long way.
Okay, well, Craig, we have to say they are heart-shaped, and we actually dug up some tape. Since I knew you were going to talk about this, it's from Stan Frankenthaler. He's the executive chef at Dunkin' Donuts. They do put a lot of thought into this.
Bless you.
And so he's describing the heart-shaped donut, the raspberry filling symbolizing love, and how they decided to, if I might say, appoint the royal pastry.
White for the wedding colors, black and white for a little bit of the formality. We knew that one of his favorites was chocolate, so we thought by adding a little drizzle of chocolate, we might really just appeal to both the bride and the groom.
Because I'm sure they're sending them over to Buckingham Palace. To have some Anthony, I know you want one, right?
I thought you'd never ask.
Right. So my hubbub is a follow-up to that, and I'm going to get to it briefly. Not to say you'd ever need one of these after eating a Dunkin' Donut, but a story which came out actually quite some time ago is that there is a very entrepreneurial British artist. Her name is Lydia Leith, who is selling... Oh, if I can say it this way, basically royal wedding puke bags. They're blue and red, and they have a little crown on them that says thrown up, and it says royal wedding sick bag, keep this handy for the big day. And my favorite part is that, of course, she sold thousands of them, and she is shipping them by none other than the Royal Mail.
Okay, now.
Okay. Still get to eat the donuts, though, right?
Absolutely.
I'm going to say these donuts are pretty good. Yeah. Stay with us. There's a lot more to come on Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. We'll be right back.